Welcome. Such a dharma is rarely met with in 100,000 million kalpas, but it can be met with in one moment of now. One moment of being time. Excuse me for forgetting to bring the few extra copies I have of Dogen's Being Time. I think many people have copies. I'll bring some more next week, and you can just listen along today as we start to go slowly through this. I think it'll be fine. To review a little bit from last week, we were talking about a brief history of time according to Buddha Dharma, as well as modern science. And I spoke about how this early Buddhist school called the Sarvastivadins, those who believe in the existence of all these things, what Sarvasta means, taught that the time, these tiny moments of time called kshana, these tiny, tiny moments are indivisible, indestructible, continuously abiding moments of time, and then bigger time periods like a second or a minute or an hour are made up of these indivisible moments, but that these indivisible moments truly exist, and therefore the past and the future truly exist according to this early Buddhist school. Which sounds strange to us, but here's an example of how we might think of that. And in fact, I think we often do think that it seems to us that the past and the future do exist. Like when we think of our past, we think all these events that happened, and that really happened. Like, it really happened. We think that. I think that's what the teachings of this school are based on. Yeah, it really happened. And it's like it doesn't change. It's the past all the way back to beginningless time is like unchangeable moments of time. The future might seem a little strange to say that the future truly exists. But like when we think of, say, we're going to go back to our house after this class, we have this image of that future. And in a way, it exists for us. Now, it may not happen, so that could disprove it, but something like this common sense way of thinking about past and future existing, I would guess is why these early Buddhists said, no, the past and future moments really exist. And one image of this would be like a railroad track extending like infinitely into the past and the future, into the foggy mists of beginning of time and end of time. And the track is, set on railroad ties, the cross wooden ties, and those are like these moments, we could say, in this metaphor, in this image, many, many, many tiny railroad ties, and they extend, and they really exist there, and they're all kind of like connected by this apparent track or stream of time, and we're like the train. And the world is like the train moving along. So we're only at one railroad tie of this present kshana, this present moment. But after we pass that, then we have all these past moments strung out behind us, and we can see ahead all these future moments like that. So that was the image that may sound strange to us, and was later seems strange to other Buddhists thinking about this. But that was a very early model of time. And then we talked about the mind-only view of time, like the Yogacara teaching that there's a storehouse consciousness that's basically giving rise to every experience ever, including this whole world that is our experience is arising from this storehouse of all experiences. And time is one of those things that arises from the storehouse consciousness. So time is a mentally constructed phenomena according to the mind-only school. So it's no longer that there's these really existent, permanent moments. Not at all. It's almost like the opposite, that we can't find any truly existent objective things like that outside of our mental experience. It's kind of the bottom line of the mind-only view. And so even time is a mental construct, and we have lots of things in our experience that can confirm that. Like, we talked about how for a four-year-old who has 1 year of life is 25% of their life, so 1 year, a quarter of their life seems to be a really big expanse relative to their whole life. Whereas for a 40-year-old, 1 year is 2.5% of their life and seems to go quite quickly. So our relative perception of time, depending how many years we've lived, changes. And that's kind of like our mental construction of experience of time changes. And changes due to all different things, too. And then what we didn't get to last week was another view of time, another Buddhist school. So we have these early Buddhist views, pre-Mahayana views of time, where things really exist, including moments of time. We have mind-only, where it's all mental construction. And then we have the middle way view of time, like Nagarjuna's teaching of time. So, of course, he has to address time. And that's, for some people, Nagarjuna is kind of a nightmare. Very difficult sometimes to understand. Nagarjuna, in his 27 chapters on the middle way, has a chapter on time, examination of time. And, you know, without getting too into this, because this is a Dogen study, but I think this is related. I think Dogen probably knew of these different, and thought about these different views of time. So this gets into past, present, and future, and so on, but at the end, I think this is the kind of conclusion of Nagarjuna. As you know, Nagarjuna is the one who says that no phenomena can actually truly be found to actually exist. And even that no phenomena actually arise. That's the first verse for those who were in our Nagarjuna class, studying how the first verse of the whole book, right, is that neither from itself, nor from another, nor from both, nor from neither, does anything whatsoever, anywhere, ever arise. So there's these four possibilities of things arising, and Nagarjuna methodically goes through these and shows how ultimately, in the end, nothing truly can be said to arise. No phenomena ever rises. So these are like things, phenomena. Of course, conventionally, everything appears to arise all the time, but ultimately, no thing arises or ceases. And so, based on that, and all these earlier chapters, they kind of go through the proofs for non-arising of things. Nagarjuna says, if time depends on an entity or a thing, then without an entity, how could time exist? There is no existent entity, which he's already spoken of, right? So how can time exist? So he's saying time depends on phenomena, which is what Dogen's going to get into too, right? Being time, the inseparability of being, which is like phenomena world, and time are inseparable. So Nagarjuna is also basing his argument on this. If time depends on phenomena, and I think we talked about last week how if no phenomena are moving, like if the whole universe stopped moving, like if the sun, you know, if the Earth going around the sun stopped in its orbit and the Earth's spin stopped, these are the things that we base our view of time on, is planetary movement. since ancient times. And even like our heartbeat stopped and everything stopped, you actually, time would be impossible, because time is a phenomena set up on the movement of physical objects, actually. So if there aren't any physical objects, then how could time exist? And he's saying ultimately, in the ultimate, from the view of ultimate truth, ultimate reality, no things exist, therefore time doesn't exist. That's a pretty simple argument. And if you want to know why no entities exist, you have to read all the other chapters. So then this is just a little commentary here by the translator, Jay Garfield. He says, finally, Nagarjuna argues, we cannot suppose that time exists as one entity dependent on some other as its ground if we want time to exist inherently. This is because, in the previous arguments in the text, we've already argued that none of the entities that exist in time are inherently existent. So none would form a suitable ontological basis for an inherently existent time. But this final verse is double-edged, and its positive reading contains Nagarjuna's positive account of the nature of time. Nagarjuna points out that with no entities to be temporally related, there is no time. That is, the only mode of existence that time has is as a set of relations among empirical phenomena. So, this is the only, he's a Western philosopher, so he uses these philosophical terms. The only mode of existence that time has is as a set of relations among empirical phenomena. So, like, physical, or we could maybe say also mental phenomena. Also last week, I think I mentioned, sometimes the Buddhist view is time is defined as a measurement of the interval between a cause and an effect. So those could also be phenomenal existence.
Could you please report one more time?
Yeah, so the only mode of existence that time has is as a set of relations among empirical phenomena. Empirical, does anyone know what empirical means?
It's, you can see it and verify it.
See it and verify it. So, what we think of as things and phenomena in the world is the basis for time. And the relationship between them, and I think particularly between cause and effect. So basically, without things, there's no time. Without being, there's no time. Apart from those phenomena and those relations, there is no time. And then, quite wonderfully, Jay Garfield, the Tibetan scholar and Western philosopher, has a little footnote that says, this insight is foundational for Dogen's later analysis of Uji, or being time. So I think that, thinking, oh, this is the key verse that sounds very similar, he picked up on that too. But that means that given the lack of inherent existence of phenomena, there can be no inherent existence of time. Time is thus merely a dependent set of relations, not an entity in its own right, and certainly not the inherently existent vessel of existence it might appear to be. I think we often think of time as like this container that we're living in, like this vessel that we move through. It almost like it's the basis. Like first it was time, and then it was being. Right? We think of it that way, and I think Dogen's exploring this radical notion that it's complete. It's inconceivable the way they're related, actually, and that there is no real thing called time. And as we explore this, let's keep remembering too how this can apply to our life. It can sound so abstract, and yet. Time is such an issue for us, right? We get so busy in doing things, and everything is done by the movement of these little moving hands or little like LCD numbers, and but they're just based on movement of objects, and yet our lives are ruled by these little things. I feel that often. So to see that we still have to live in accord with that. And yet, how do we live not take it as the inherently existent container that's trapping us in time. To just harmonize with the, in a way, it's the two truths, right? Mm-hmm. Ultimately, there is no time, but that's a one-sided thing. Conventionally, we agree to meet for class at 6:35, so we just come then, and sometimes we're late, and then that's what happens. Sometimes we're early, that's what happens. But the union of the conventional truth and ultimate truth is where Dharma practice takes place. And even though Dogen, breaks down this whole notion of time, he lived, as far as we know, in this monastic container that's totally structured around time. I also thought of that that image that we're now in this practice period, right? So practice period in our English translation there, it's a period of time. It's like setting aside a certain time where we do an opening ceremony and a closing ceremony, and between those we say, during this time, it's pretty arbitrary, but during this particular time period, let's kind of intensify our commitment to practice. And it's kind of ridiculous in a certain way, because it's just like, why are we setting up this certain time? But it seems like an ancient phenomena going back to the Buddha in India, who said, let's have this 3-month rainy season retreat, and we're going to mark it by the moon. That's how the original 3-month practice periods were set up. One full moon to 3 later full moons, so we're going to use these planetary movements. But Dogen, in his Shobo Genzo chapter called Practice Period, says something like, he may be quoting his teacher, I forget if it's him or Ru Jing, but he says something like, practice period is like gouging out a cave in empty space, like carving out a cave, which is an empty space, in empty space. Carving out this, like, arbitrary little subset of empty space within bigger empty space. So it's kind of like that. You could say a period of zazen or a practice period is like a cave of empty space within empty space, ultimately, and yet we begin it and end it. So here's also another little commentary on Nagarjuna's view of time. So, realizing the emptiness, true nature of time, which is the emptiness of time, prevents us from getting attached to the length of time that we practice as being real. Some people think that they need to meditate for long periods of time, or else it's not really Dharma practice. So these are the kind of practical applications of the emptiness of time. Others feel proud because they think they've been practicing Dharma for a certain number of years and they're advanced practitioners as a result. Others get disappointed because they think they've been practicing for a long time and do not see any improvement in their situation. They might get so disappointed that they abandon practice altogether. Still others are in a big hurry and think that they have to achieve enlightenment as soon as possible. Realizing that time is not truly existent and that long and short periods of time are equality frees us from all these types of attachment and mental agitation that they cause. This freedom from attachment is open, spacious, and relaxed. Also, realizing the true nature of time is particularly important for bodhisattvas who vow to liberate every single one of the infinite number of sentient beings from samsara, no matter how many eons that might take. So in our vast bodhisattva vows, we vow to save all beings, and since they're numberless, this might take a while. Also, since delusions are inexhaustible, it might take a while to end them. And Dharma gates are boundless, it might take a while to enter them. And Buddha's way is unsurpassable, it might take a while to become it. But since the bodhisattvas are free from attachment to long or short periods of time as being real, they can make that commitment quite eagerly and happily. Nice.
I never thought of that. That's very helpful.
It's a way out of that conundrum.
It's a way out of the conundrum.
The time is in the... Yeah. Yeah. Since bodhisattvas are free from attachment to long or short periods of time as being real, they can make that commitment quite eagerly and happily. As the Buddha taught, an eon and an instant are equality, and knowing this, bodhisattvas are able to remain in samsara, this painful realm, and continuously perform deeds that benefit sentient beings without ever getting tired or discouraged. Yes, yes, that's part of why those emptiness teachings are so important in the Mahayana, where bodhisattvas course, because if sentient beings truly existed, the bodhisattvas would get very impatient, realizing how long it takes to free them all from suffering. So the beings don't ultimately exist, and time doesn't ultimately exist. However, bodhisattvas also don't get stuck in just the ultimate. So they, in the conventional relative world, they can actually go through this relatively painful process of being with all these beings in their great suffering for countless eons, for apparently countless eons. So there's three different schools of Buddhism approaching this notion of time. Another image. So time is kala, right? In Sanskrit, there are different words for time, but one of the main ones is kala. Like the kala chakra ceremony is the wheel of time. And we have this Indian kind of wrathful deity, fierce dharma protector called Mahakala. So great time. It's the great time protector. And it's this black being that actually we have in Japanese Zen. In fact, we have enshrined right here at Warm Jewel Temple. We have
at the bathroom.
Actually, it's at the kitchen.
Oh, the kitchen.
The kitchen. All those little kitchen dharma protectors plaque out there, and one of the kitchen dharma protectors is Daikoku Sonten, which in Japanese means great black one, but. Daikoku is the Japanese version of Mahakala, apparently, and somehow got connected with the kitchen.
Soot.
Maybe got black from soot. But I also have this image of when I was thinking of Johnny as Tenzo in there during the sashin, and constantly, diligently cooking the food and getting it out just on time. So like Mahakala is this like, kind of wrathful time being that's like, you can't mess with me, I am like totally fierce and strong, you can't get around me. Yeah, and so I'm going to protect the kitchen here and protect the time that the meals get out, but like you can't get around me basically.
When it's serve up time,
when it's serve up time, it's
ready.
Time
you can't come and taste everybody. And, oh, sorry.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's going to be another 25 minutes here.
You know, the food has to cook in its own time. No, it's time.
Right.
And of course, it does cook, and it has its own time for cooking. And so it's the time is ruling the tenzo with its cooking time too. I don't know if there's any of these ideas went into that dharma protector being associated with the kitchen or not, but this is imaginative. Kala, with his, in the Indian version, his mouth is like dripping with blood and big fangs and yeah, and so yeah, related to Kali, and I always thought it was just a version of Kali, yeah. So often Kala would be the feminine and or masculine, and Kali would be the feminine. So we could look into this more, but one commentary on time said Mahakala is the great time being. And I think there's some they said on Tibetan calendars, sometimes the days of the calendar are surrounded by this wrathful Mahakala. It's like, again, you know, you time is kind of like hard for us to take, and yet it's protecting us at the same time. So it's a Dharma protector, time, and it's fierce. As we approach death, maybe even fiercer, it shows no mercy. Time just keeps rolling along. Black muddy river. So, Shobogenzo Uji, the time being. So this title, Uji, these two characters, U means being or existent, and it's often paired up with Mu. Mu means non-existent, or it can also just mean no or nothing. But you often, in these kind of like Buddhist dialectics, when they get into the relationship of existence and non-existence, it's these two characters are at play, Mu and U. And Dogen often plays with them together. So being, and then Ji means time. And together as a compound, it just in regular Japanese language, it would be pronounced Arutoki. Arutoki means like basically sometimes.
What's the Arutoki?
Arutoki. So Arutoki is like in, you know, the Japanese way of pronunciation, and Uji is the Japanese version of Chinese pronunciation. So there's like different readings of characters. So you know, so in colloquial language in ancient and modern Japanese, they'd say like Arutoki, you know, sometimes I go to the Zendo and sometimes I don't.
So Arutoki is the modern use of
these
symbols?
Right. They would use these characters to mean just sometimes. And so, as opposed to like existent time or being time, it doesn't relate, the common use doesn't have that connotation. But Dogen, as he often does with language, and it's as non-Japanese speakers, it's hard to pick up on a lot of his play with what he does here, but he'll often take like a just regular colloquial reading of Japanese, and he'll use it in, he'll kind of go to the very literal meaning of it. Like he'll take the literal characters that actually means existent, which is this kind of juicy character in Buddhist philosophy, this U character, and combine it with time and say, now we're not just saying sometimes, we're saying being time, or for the, some translations in English say, for the time being. And his commentary is going to bring out that he's not just talking about sometimes, but this more like complete expression of what is in this moment. The here and now, time being. So, like, it begins with an ancient Buddha, who's Yaoshan, saying, for the time being, stand on top of the highest peak. But it may well be that that originally, that even Yaoshan saying this in Chinese was more like, sometimes stand on the top of the highest peak. Sometimes proceed along the bottom of the deepest ocean. And so some of the English translations say it that way, and they say, well, this is, the original meaning was like sometimes, and then Dogen's gonna start commenting on it from this other point of view of the time being. So again, it's hard to do this in English translation, but this one just starts right off. For the time being, or we could say for being time, time being is just reversing the characters. You know, in the realm of being time, stand on the top of the highest peak. Or some say standing on top of the highest peak. Not necessarily like a command to stand on the top, but just for the time being, standing on top of the highest peak. It's just an image of the time being manifesting at the very tippy top of a mountain. For the time being, proceed along the bottom of the deepest ocean. For the time being, three heads and eight arms. And then often the commentaries say, this is an image of these, like, of a fighting demon, like an Asura, or maybe Dharma Protector. And I forgot to look, but I thought this might be interesting to see if this, if Kala, if there's images of Mahakala with three heads and eight arms, which would be a very cool little, like, you know, reference to the great time being with these arms and heads. But none of the commentators picked up on that possible reference. For the time being, an 8 or 16 foot body of the Buddha, sometimes the Buddha's golden body is said to have been this huge, radiant body. For the time being, a staff or a whisk. For the time being, a pillar or lantern. For the time being, the children of the common families, Zhang and Li. These are like saying Smith and Jones in English. They're just common family names. For the time being, the earth and sky. The great ground and the empty sky. And, you know, staff and whisk are like these Zen implements, and pillar and lanterns are these common temple ornaments. So, it's just a list of stuff that exists in the time being. Exists for the time being. Exists as being time. A poetic list of Dharma things. And that's basically the whole quote from ancient Buddha Yaoshan. Yes.
You know, as I read these, I've read this now a number of times, and each time what this series of observations is, these are all potentially really profound insight moments.
Mm.
And some of them contradict each other.
Yeah, well, they're often...
Tranquil Buddha, 16 feet, and then these fighting things. Mm. And he's saying that all of these things, which appear to be different, are the same thing in all time being.
You know, are they the same thing? They all exist in the time being.
In the time being. Mm-hmm. In other words, the time being is the important element.
Yes.
There's no element that's more important or significant than any other.
That's, yes, I think that's right.
They all are coming out of this fountain of time being.
Yeah, they're all manifesting as the time being equally. Yeah, maybe not really we say they're exactly the same, but they're equally the time being.
Yes.
Yeah. And they are kind of like sets of opposites, like the top of the peak and the bottom of the ocean, the Buddha and the demons, the whisks and staffs in the temple hall, and the pillars and lanterns maybe outside the temple hall, the children of Smith and Jones children, and earth and sky, like the world of people and world of phenomena and nature. And so basically then Dogen starts his commentary, and he basically says it all in the first sentence. He says, for the time being here means time itself is being, and all being is time. He really just like unloads it all right there at the beginning. Why go on? But he does go on for four pages. But I think that's the key understanding of Dogen there. The time itself is being, and all being is time. A golden 16-foot body is time. Because it is time, there is the radiant illumination of time. Study it as the 12 hours of the present. Three heads and eight arms is time. Because it is time, it's not separate from the 12 hours of the present. Or literally that says, it is one suchness with the 12 hours of the present. And, as Dogen often says, he brings up study, study it, gaku. So this encouragement to actually investigate this issue of the time being, thoroughly investigate, Dogen's constantly pushing us to do. And of course he wrote all this stuff, so he probably intended us for to do such with his work. So it's just a little reminder that we might think, well, Dogen's Soto Zen is just sitting and letting go of all thought, and like any kind of thought or study or investigation is going against the way of Dogen Zen. Nonsense. All this must be thoroughly investigated. But investigate, study it as the 12 hours of the present. So the in Zen, investigation and study is always in the present. That's a key aspect too. The 12 hours of the present. So all these issues, it's going to take probably more than 12 hours to go through all this, but all of it will be expressions of the time being. And we can also, you know, remembering these early Buddhist views, we can start to see how Dogen might be playing with all these different aspects of the truly existent time and past and future extending outward, that those do exist, but they're all contained in the present, or that all of this is just mind, and therefore we can say anything about time, and the time's empty, but it does appear to arise as the time being. All of these different views on time, he's going to just really explore this as much as he can. Even though you do not measure the hours of the day as long or short, far or near, you still call it 12 hours. So we sometimes maybe don't measure the hours as, you know, that was a short hour or a long hour. Even though our experience might be such, we call it 12 hours. And maybe in a kind of superficial way, we just say, oh, that took 12 hours, instead of that took like these all these realms of coming and going and the mind turning somersaults to accomplish this. We just say it took 12 hours. Because the signs of time's coming and going are obvious, people do not doubt it. And I think, so here we go, right? We work from this hour to this hour, we come at this hour and this hour. The signs of time passing are so obvious that we never question it or doubt it. So he's saying, now let's take a deeper look. Let's start maybe checking out if it's really the case. I think that's a great sentence in itself, you know. Because it's the signs are so obvious, we don't doubt it. Although people do not doubt it, they do not understand it. Or when sentient beings doubt what they do not understand, their doubt is not firmly fixed. So when beings, either they people think they understand it, so they don't bother to doubt it in a good way. We were talking about doubt recently, right? In Dharma Talk, I think, Wednesday, yeah. And how there's corrosive doubt and then there's appropriate and valuable doubt. And I think here he's kind of saying this should be doubted. Our common sense understanding should be doubted. And people may not doubt it and not understand it, but sometimes they know they don't understand it and they doubt it. Or they start doubting it and realize that they don't understand what time is when they start doubting it. Which seems actually the most appropriate. This is the way I would interpret him here. That seems pretty good. They realize they don't understand time, and they doubt their usual understanding, but their doubt is not firmly fixed. And I don't know, but I take this as like they doubt it for like during the time being class. They start to doubt their whole thing, and then they go home and just start like, oh, I'm so late again. I'm so busy. You know, the doubt's not almost like. I take this as like he's kind of promoting a firmly fixed doubt, a continuous doubt in this way that like constantly doubting our common sense experience as a valuable way to practice. Like, you know, is anything I think about anything actually really what's happening? I think that's a bodhisattva's doubt.
You know, in this conversation we had Wednesday, when I was young, I would make definitive statements.
But you never do that anymore.
My mother would counsel me, why not say, it seems to me, or in my opinion. You know? And that I think is the kind of persistent doubt that says, well, I may have a very solid idea in my mind, but it's just my opinion. It may not be accurate given more data. As opposed to doubting doubt, when I would say, oh, this is it.
Yes.
You know, doubt has no use here. I doubt that doubt is useful here, which is actually an assertion of something as fact.
Or is I just hearing some comment, some maybe modern Zen person talking about his teacher or something, who said something like, you know, the greatest thing he said is every statement he made, he said, he would say, in my opinion, or, you know, I think such and such. So therefore, he knew that basically everything he ever thought was just his own opinion. So maybe it's good, though, to always, at least, if we don't say it, at least be thinking, well, in my opinion, this is so. When sentient beings doubt what they do not understand, their doubts not firmly fixed. Because of that, their past doubts do not necessarily coincide with the present doubt. Yet doubt itself is nothing but time. Doubt itself is nothing but time. Yes.
You know, I love this fascicle, even though it's difficult, and I know from having read it a lot that you couldn't say everything was time. So I'm wondering if you have a suggestion about how to listen to each of the times he says it with some kind of freshness. You know, because otherwise it's like it's a refrain that. Maybe that's his point here. It's like, if I... I'm working myself out of the skinny branches. You know what I mean?
Well, I think you could say he said it all in the first sentence, and so why go on? But then I think the beauty of studying Dogen in this kind of setting where we can actually kind of line by line, sentence by sentence go through, you start to see how he's actually... making a new particular point. He's kind of nuancing this understanding with each sentence. Sometimes I feel like he's just having fun and just kind of like being wacky. But often I think he's making a particular point. And so like in this case, so I think a way to do it is just to try to be open to say, it's not just this general kind of fuzzy thing of like, all being is time, we got it. To actually see, like, are there new points being made? Because I think there are. And in this case, it's about doubt. Yes?
Well, the original list, for the time being, the high speak, etc., is all physical phenomena. This would be the first time that he includes mental phenomena as being time.
Doubt. Oh, Yeah, he includes mental phenomena, which is definitely important to include that. And also, doubt is a key thing that Dogen brings up quite a bit. Like, we had a session on One Bright Pearl, and I think there's a line right near the end there where Dogen says, even... the doubt that's arising that, you know, this is sort of paraphrasing or my memory of what he was saying.
I need to look on page 31, this one break.
Well, maybe he doesn't say, this one doesn't say, give the word doubt exactly, but He says, even when you're perplexed or troubled, those perplexed and troubled thoughts are not apart from the bright pearl, as there are no... Yeah, basically that line. I think another translation actually says doubts. Even though you may doubt this teaching that the whole world in 10 directions is one bright pearl, that very doubt is not apart from the bright pearl. And I think there's other places too where Dogen brings up the issue of doubt that gets consumed within the one bright pearl, or in this case, the time being.
Perplexing thoughts, doubts, and or accepting or rejecting are but passing trivial notions. It is moreover only the pearl appearing as a trivial notion.
Yeah, so the pearl can appear as a trivial notion or as a doubt, and so can the time being. So, and I think as I've mentioned before, you know, for me in my practice life, doubt has been a big issue. Like, doubt's been one of those hindrances that I've struggled with. Doubting, can this be so? Is this really the path to complete liberation? And so on. And is this really the right track? Those kind of doubts. And then to hear those teachings are like nectar when you're in that mode. Of like, that very doubt. It doesn't have to be eliminated. You don't have to get over that doubt and start trusting. Like, to actually really take up the truth that this very doubt is the manifestation of the whole works, or the bright pearl, right now. So for like doubting types, then they're gonna have to manifest the time being of doubt. So doubt itself is nothing but time. You know, and he's playing with this whole issue now too, around you're doubting your perception of time, and whether that's right or not, and you're doubting it correctly or incorrectly. But you know, doubting and not doubting too are all the time being. So it's starting to develop this, you know, all inclusivity of the time being, including doubt might be a big one for some. Place right now. So the way the self arrays itself is the true form of the entire world.
You know, I like Nishijima's translation here. This goes to the freshness that, for me, that Kathy was talking about. So we have all this muddled stuff going on, and then he says, according to this translation, we put ourselves in order and see the resulting state as the whole universe. Hmm. This act of putting ourselves in order, say through Zazen, we see all this model as being the whole universe. So he's saying we have something in the present moment that we do that resolves all of this model.
That would be one take, is to say, like, at a certain... getting the self together. This one says, the way the self arrays itself is the form of the entire world or universe. So, you know, it may be that, like, we see it at this point, but I would take this as that now we're exploring the issue of, like you said, first it was physical phenomena, then mental phenomena. Now we're talking about the very self. And I think we're... Of course, there's no independent self in Buddha Dharma, so, but there is a dependently arising self, right? That's this one, and it's actually can also be called the time being of this body and mind experience, and that is not a fixed entity that's you know, stuck in bondage. It's the free expression of a never before arising body and mind, 5 skandhas of the moment, always in the moment. And so we can call that the true self, or we could call it the momentarily arising interdependent self. So the way that that self arrays itself or is it gets itself
We put ourselves in order.
Yeah, so that kind of does imply that there's a practice putting oneself in order. I'm kind of seeing it as more like when the self is in order, we could say maybe putting the self in order is seeing that the self is in order. Mm-hmm. The dependently arisen self is completely ordered by all conditions every moment. But the point here is that I'm interpreting it as it can't be otherwise. It's like there's nothing we particularly have to do to be the time being, that the dependently arising self of the moment is inherently and irrefutably the time being. And we don't have to do anything, but there are times when we appreciate that more than others.
The difficulty I have with that interpretation you have, you may be correct, I don't know, but when we speak of the time being existing somewhat independently of the self being the self, then we get a kind of
notification
of it.
No independent, no, that the self is the time being.
Well, I understand.
The self arrayed as the self.
The self is a manifestation of time being, I understand. Uh-huh. But the self is also an active presence in all of that. We have karma, we have intentions, we have all these kinds of things which condition the self as it arises.
I'd say those things are the dependently co-arisen self, the karma, and so on.
But I don't know that we can say time being is separate from that process.
No, it's not at all separate. It is that process.
So what we are doing at this moment is time being.
Yes.
So we are, in fact, putting ourselves in order.
Mm. Well, putting ourselves. So anyway, Rich.
Well, I thought this translation says it a little bit different way, but I read it like you're saying it, rather than saying putting ourselves in order. Well, let's see if I can find it. These are good paragraphs.
I think that is the same translation, putting the self in order.
This doesn't say that. No, this says, I wish I had a pencil or whatever. This says that when we arrive in the field of the ineffable, there is just one concrete thing and one concrete phenomenon here and now, beyond understanding of phenomena and non-understanding of phenomena.
I think that's later. That's a little later.
That's later?
Yeah.
Oh. Okay. I thought arriving in the field of the ineffable was putting ourselves in order.
No, that's later.
There really is this word self is involved here. Yes.
It says here, we can say for the present, however, the doubt is nothing other than time. Right. We put ourselves in order and see the resulting effect.
Yes, Michelle.
I'm simple-minded, but I hear this as saying only that the only reality is our perception of it.
And that's called the self?
The way the self raises itself, the way we are at any given moment,
mm-hmm.
is the entire world.
Yeah. And you could say that's our perception. The dependently co-arisen self is only experienced as our perception of it and of the universe. Like our perception of the universe is the dependently co-arisen event of this body-mind. There's also other stuff like, I guess you could say it's all, especially from a mind-only point of view, I was saying, well, what about like, is the big toe that's part of the dependently co-arisen self? But actually there isn't really a big toe apart from our perception of it. So, you could say it's the who we are, the dependently co-arisen self, particularly from a kind of mind-only point of view, is the present moment perception of the universe. And it's unique. It's like we all perceive the universe differently in this moment.
And there is no universe except outside our perception of it.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's, I think, one aspect of the self being brought up here is that it's the time being is completely unique to every individual. There's not like a universal time being apart from the people experiencing it.
Mm-hmm. Let's see what this one says. Wouldn't that be being fully aware of the impermanence and the codependence and the no abiding self as we even see the self? Isn't that really putting ourselves in order? seeing the self constantly replacing itself?
You could say that. Like, here's another one that sounds similar to that. We set the self out in array.
Yeah.
So that's also saying that it's something that we're doing. So that has a similar...
But conventionally, we see ourselves as the driver of the car, the doer of the job, and this kind of thing.
Yeah.
We have kind of a fixity about that.
This one actually says, we set the self out in array and make that the whole world.
Make that the whole world.
Like the setting, putting the self in order is creating the world. And the footnote says, from the standpoint of this true self and suchness, all things are manifestations of itself. Thus, what we actually see when we look at the world is ourself set out in array. That's a footnote, but I think that's a nice footnote.
Yeah,
which is similar to what Michelle said. Yeah. Also, it's, you know, there's a little note that says, in this Shobogenzo Uji, except where reference is clearly made to the unenlightened self, the words self or I are synonymous with being time. So, like, he's never going to be talking about the, you know, independent, fixed Atman kind of self. So, to continue... See each thing in this entire world as a moment of time. Things do not hinder or interfere with one another, just as moments do not hinder one another. So see each thing. I think literally it's like, see each head, object, in this entire world as a moment of time. Things do not hinder one another, just as moments of time do not hinder one another. So like the day doesn't hinder the night, and so on. So this may be the time to bring up, because it's a very related topic here, this topic of Dharma position that is brought up in the Genjo Koan. So you might be familiar with this whole section in the Genjo Koan about firewood and ash is really exploring time. It's all about time. And, you know, it was written a little bit earlier, but not so much earlier. And it has this, in that section on how time works in the Genjo Koan, we have this notion of the Dharma position. So this is the Genjo Koan. Says, firewood becomes ash, and it does not become firewood again. Yet do not suppose that the ash is future and the firewood past. You should understand that firewood abides in the phenomenal expression, which is also translated as Dharma position, of firewood, which fully includes past and future and is independent of past and future. And ash, similarly. Just as firewood does not become firewood again after ash, you do not return to birth after death. So then he's saying, birth does not turn into death, death does not turn into birth, as we talked about last week too, that technically, strictly speaking, things don't change. There's no change in Buddha Dharma, there's just arising and ceasing. So death doesn't change into birth and vice versa. Birth is an expression complete this moment. Death is an expression complete this moment. Like winter and spring, you do not call winter the beginning of spring, nor summer the end of spring. And expression complete this moment is a slightly different twist on this Dharma position. So, which is a term that comes apparently originally from the Lotus Sutra, but it was used slightly differently. And then, Juri, the great founder of Tiantai Buddhism in China, who was a big fan of the Lotus Sutra, to use that term and kind of redefined it in the way that became the common understanding in China and Japan that Dogen pretty much picks up on, which is like basically the time being. It's like a phenomenon, like this watch is abiding in its Dharma position, or its phenomenal expression. Phenomena is another word for dharma. Abides in this phenomenal expression. It's dharma position. So it's like, it's basically, it's point in time and being dependent on all the conditions that are giving rise to it right now. So it's like the dependently arisen specific watch here. Dependently arisen, meaning like it's appearing to arise right here, right now, in this specific location, dependent on all the conditions that are giving rise to it, which are like, you know, things like the watchmaker and so on, but also, and maybe more importantly, it's dependent on our concept of watches. Like, we actually think that it's a watch because it has like a handle and numbers on it and stuff. And if you started changing parts of it, we wouldn't think of it as that. So it actually depends for its arising in the moment as our conceptual idea of a watch. And it like depends on being like an object with a certain shape and so on. These are all like kind of conceptual things that it depends on. But it's arising, it's appearing in this world. It's appearing to arise, strictly we should say, because Nagarjuna, as we just heard, says actually this watch doesn't really arise. The ultimate truth is it doesn't actually arise, but conventionally speaking, it appears to arise, but in a very particular way, like right here, in its dharma position. Like, now it's still in its dharma position. Everything is always in its dharma position, right? It can't escape that, but it's completely unique. And this is a beautiful passage from the Gendo Koan says, it abides in its phenomenal expression as firewood, which fully includes past and future. Like the firewood includes the tree in the past and includes the ash in the future, which fully includes past and future and is independent of past and future. That's the key, Dogen's key thing about time here. So again, this railroad track thing, we could say from that point of view, this present railroad tie includes all these infinite railroad ties in both directions, but it's also completely independent of them at the same time.
So we have this tree.
A tree.
We have this tree, and it's cut down. Mm-hmm. And the core of it is honed into a beam.
Mm-hmm.
And what was right next to that is kind of like debris.
Mm-hmm.
And the core of this tree, which is wood of this tree, becomes a roof beam, and that is its future.
Mm-hmm.
There's no ash in that future. It's not inevitable that the wood mm-hmm. become ash. The wood right next to it, however, that mm-hmm. is humaned off, is designated as firewood, as a human intention.
Yeah.
And then it becomes ash. But the ash itself has also many purposes. It can be used for cleaning pots. It can be used to make soap. It can be used to fertilize. So depending upon the intention that we put on that ash has many different futures. And none of them are set. They're all dependent upon the conditions that we bring to that at that moment.
Yeah, they're
so
not
ash
fixed.
Has an independent past and future that is not inherent.
Yeah, it's dependent. The past and the future are always dependent. So that's why this really early version of a fixed future doesn't really make sense. That Sarvastivada view of these indestructible moments of past and future. And yet, the future actually, the future ash, we could say, depends on the firewood. And the firewood, in a way, the piece that's going to be firewood, some is going to be firewood and some is going to be a roof beam, but the part that's going to be firewood, we could say, and this is where there's different versions of this, but there are these, and I'll bring up this Huayan version of time, of this multi-dimensional version of time, where they say that actually depends on the future ash. This right now, we don't know that until the future comes, but it's this kind of like interfusion of past, present, and future time, where it's all completely interdependent and beyond our understanding even. But yeah, none of it's fixed or set out. And I think it's easy to, some of these, like that early view, it starts to sound like predestiny or something. Like the future's already determined. Which, that doesn't make sense in terms of dependent co-arising.
It's more potential.
Yeah, the firewood?
The future is more of a potential, but it's not necessarily fixed.
Yeah, it's funny, you know, it's not fixed like, it's not fixed in the sense of like, predestined,
preordained,
but you could say in a way it's fixed in the according to the law of dependent co-arising, which is a very strict law. Like nothing can get around that law. Just like nothing can escape Mahakala. It's like it's going to things will manifest according to conditions, whatever those conditions are, and we can't see what they're going to be, but.
They're determined.
Yeah, they're in a way it's determined, not predetermined, but determined.
So if you apply heat to the wood, it's going to burn, you're going to get ash.
Yeah, so this is why, like again, according to that first verse of Nagarjuna, nothing random ever happens. You know, you can kind of, like, that's part of what the law of dependent co-arising says. What we think is random, actually, there are conditions. We just don't see the conditions. But nothing happens, no thing happens without conditions. That's like the law of dependent co-arising. We could say suddenly something appears, but we just don't, we call it random or spontaneous just when we don't understand the conditions, we can't see them. But there were some there. Yes, Kathy?
But then what's the difference? Okay, you said that things don't change, and they don't become each other.
Yeah.
They arise and cease and arise and cease. But now you're saying that nothing exists without the conditions that created it.
Same thing. So things changing into one, like that would be like a view that there is some, like a flower sprouting, living, and then wilting, would be like there's some kind of like flowerness in there that's changing from one form to another. But it's actually that the sprout abiding in its phenomenal expression in its Dharma position is just the sprout, and it includes the past and the future. And then, according to conditions, it ceases. So it does. So that's I think one of the key things. It doesn't change into something because that implies there's something that's changing. There's no thing that's changing. There's just arising and cessation, and the cessation becomes a condition for the arising of the next moment of a little bit bigger sprout.
But they're related.
They're very related. Very related.
And they're related in the way that, particularly in our perception, of some kind of
Related is another way of saying dependent mm-hmm. or dependently co-arising is the relationship of one moment in time that ceases and then another moment. So they're related in terms of interdependence. Related or dependent on the previous, then one moment's dependent on the previous moment, but it's not like there's something changing. There's arising and ceasing, mm-hmm. and the point here is that fits in completely with this arising and ceasing thing. Is each moment there's one moment of a Dharma abiding in its moment, not even momentary, really. You know, it's just a fleeting appearance of a something in a Dharma position. That's what's meant by the Dharma position. Is one moment of time being, and then it ceases, and then another one arises.
Like a film strip.
Like a film strip is a nice metaphor. Yeah, that appears like a film is changing.
No frame is changing. You have separate frames, but our mind makes a continuity out of it.
Yeah, our mind makes it looks like the film is changing, but actually each image in the film abides in its Dharma position, which fully includes past and future frames,
yes.
But it's independent of past and future frames.
Yes.
Fits very nicely with that. Yes, Maddie.
Often find in these discussions that maybe it's just because I need a shortcut or something, but I just keep coming back to this idea of the middle way that there's cause and effect, and there's no cause and effect. There's a spontaneity fresh of every moment to be completely fresh and new. And we're subject to cause and effect, and they're just two faces of the same die.
I think we'll.
So then I don't get too worried about trying to make sure I've got it right here or got it right there. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, they're just completely contradictory and they exist together. That we are free every moment to be totally fresh and new, and
I'm a product of my history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think we could say, yeah, those are two sides of a coin. And you could say that's the two truths in Buddhism, mm-hmm. too. The cause and effect, which we could also call dependent co-arising, is actually the apparent arising of phenomena. And the other side of the same coin is what we call emptiness, or no cause and effect. And it's really like, that's the ultimate truth, that actually nothing's really arising and ceasing. And we could say, to say that spontaneous, it's almost like either one could be said. In a way, cause and effect is also, we could call spontaneous, because things arise according to conditions in surprising ways. I would almost put spontaneous in the cause and effect side, actually. And that this other side of, like, where nothing's arising and ceasing, it's like ooh and moo, also. In this side, it's like, even to say spontaneity is like, it's like nothing's actually happening, ultimately, is like, and those go together, in the sense, this is Nagarjuna's whole middle way thing, about the proof for nothing happening is the fact that things depend on each other, so they can't exist independently, and that non-independent existence is this side of, like, no thing, not even arising as a phenomena can't be found in some actual way.
Independent arising.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, middle way, in a way it's very simple, but it's very, I think we have to keep exploring it endlessly, because it's so subtle, and to get more and more familiar with these, yeah. And
well,
those are two sides.
Understanding it, you know, I can understand the middle way, you know, just by laying it out logically. Mm. But practicing is a very different matter.
But
hard.
Dogen's got this great poem that's something like, you know, mind itself is Buddha. It's like the arising side. Mind itself is Buddha. Something like, you know, practice is difficult, explanation is easy. Mm-hmm. Not mind, not Buddha. Practice is easy, explanation is difficult. That's an interesting exploration of those two sides, too. That, like, you know, not mind, not Buddha. You can't not practice it, mm-hmm. but, like, how do you, you know, to explain emptiness, mm-hmm. is going to be very difficult.
Mm-hmm. I've seen various hands that
are, yeah.
I've seen Harry and I've seen Jeff.
Harry?
You know, going back to predestination, mm-hmm. since I'm an old Presbyterian, it seems to me that basically in the Mahayana, you have essentially the same argument that you have Buddha. It's constantly seeing the future in most of the sutras, and so if he can see the future, it's already there.
Mm. Yeah, there is this, like, you know, the omniscience of a Buddha,
so that
in the Mahayana.
In this concept of time, there is also the ability of the Buddha to step outside.
It seems like there is something like that in these cosmic visions of the Mahayana sutras, that the Buddha can actually, yeah, predict the enlightenment of all these Buddhas and even tell them what their names will be in the future Buddha land, like the Lotus Sutra is full of that. Yeah, yeah. And so it's something outside our experience, but I think the Mahayana gets into these stories of vast interpenetration of time, and like we talked about, some modern science can also seem to be like, you could, Stephen Hawking says you could theoretically make a time machine that would go into, you could go into the future and past, so it's inconceivable to us, but I think it's just talking about how awesome Buddhas are. Yes?
I was thinking about what you said about the flower,
mm-hmm.
in combination with saying that nothing really changes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like every arising and ceasing is like pictures in the film.
Yeah.
And what I have a problem with is to incorporate what I know about the fact that you can actually, let's say with the flower, that you can actually, if you look at the genome of a flower, you can actually see the imprints of time in there, you know what I mean?
You mean the past
time? Yeah, you can see rays of mutation, things change, you can see them.
Well, it's the same thing that you see. I mean, I think you don't even need to go there to see that, well, it definitely appears to be changing, but you could say that genome of a past, that's why it's abiding in its Dharma position in the present, but that fully includes that past sign. I mean, we see everything is leaving footprints of the past, so we see all those signs, but it doesn't, it's still this different kind of vision of that in the moment, this thing is just like this, and it appears to have left like a footprint in the sand or a genome imprint of the past moment. So it's not like, again, there's like Kathy was saying, well, is there no relation? There's completely relation between them. There's a relation between the footprint in the sand and the foot down here on the beach now. But the foot down here on the beach now is, from this point of view, didn't... you know, that footprint didn't come from this foot. You know, it's like that moment ceased. And the cessation of the moment, we could say, leaves an imprint. So that's why there appears to be the past. That's why those early Buddhists actually said the past, it can't be destroyed. It's like an indestructible past. But from a kind of mind-only point of view, we could say, well, those past imprints are like, that's the whole storehouse consciousness model. It's like it's all about past imprints are being